Hello, this is Feb Stokes, the podcast series of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. My name is László Andor, I'm the Secretary General of FEPS. Today's conversation is recorded in Greece, in the city of Patras, where I have the great honor and pleasure to meet George Papandreou, the former Prime Minister of Greece. George, thank you so much for accepting my invitation.
My honor, László, to be with you here in Patras. Welcome.
It's a wonderful day here. I think I don't need to specifically mention that it's a sunny day. But I think we should also discuss the more difficult aspects of politics. It was a very difficult time when you were Prime Minister. But I think that should not be the main topic today, because less people are aware of your current activities, because you are very active not only in the Parliament of Greece, but also in the Council of Europe, where you focus on questions of democracy, which is today a very difficult subject, partly because of European concerns, but also challenges, I could even say shocks, coming from outside Europe.
Absolutely.
Would you like to explain what is in the focus of your current activity in the Council of Europe?
Well, the Council of Europe, as you know, has three pillars, and one of it is democracy, the other one is rule of law, and of course, human rights. And the issue of democracy has come up more and more. The new Secretary General, who was elected last year, Alain Berset, Swiss former Prime Minister, has also put this as a priority for the, and he's now proposing for a new democratic pact. I was elected and given a mandate in the Council of Europe, in the Parliamentary Assembly, as General Rapporteur for Democracy. That's a very lofty title. And my task is to look at what are the threats and why we are we seeing in parts of the country, parts of the world, but particularly in Europe, since we're in the Council of Europe, the backsliding of democracy, the undermining of trust in our institutions. And then also trying to understand, see what are the possible innovations or new approaches or new ways of thinking about these democratic institutions to make sure that democracy is robust, is secure, democratic security, democratic shields, whatever. There are many different terms that are being used. So that's what I have been focusing on. And of course, very much looking at some of the areas which are not necessarily traditionally talked about in the Council of Europe. So how the economy and the different economic developments in the world, global capitalism and so on, has affected democracy, the new technologies, social platforms, digital platforms and so on, how they have also affected the democratic debate. These are issues which are, of course, of importance. But even more, some specific issues, geopolitics and democracy, mm-hmm. the question of internal democracy in our parties. I think it's an important issue in Europe also. And how religion, identity politics, how that affects our democratic debate. These are, I think, some of the big issues we need to talk about.
Well, this is certainly a common concern between Brussels and Strasbourg, if I can say it this way. But the word backsliding was indeed mentioned. Give me some relief that it's not only about Hungary.
Yes, absolutely. More general. Absolutely. I think Hungary is, because I happen to also be on the in the so-called monitoring committee, and I am one of the rapporteurs for Hungary with another friend, colleague from Estonia. Eric Cross, we are together, been visiting Hungary and making assessments. We've made a report a year ago, and now we'll do another report after the decision of the Parliamentary Assembly to continue this and deepen the monitoring, if you like. I think what's interesting is that much of the Project 2025 of the Heritage Foundation, which is the project which Trump he didn't openly say that he has adopted it, but basically he has adopted the people and the program of the 2025 was very much inspired by Orban, Viktor Orban, and his work in Hungary. So my take on this, there are a number of issues. One thing we have often focused a lot on the institutional issues of democracy, the courts, the human rights, violations, media freedom. And I think we've forgotten, and I think as socialists we need to do this even more so, the market, how it has developed, and how it has created at the global level huge, first of all, inequalities, where we have seen in the United States what basically I think we have seen is 50 years of America becoming much richer, much more productive, and 50 years of workers, wage earners, and middle class becoming more poor, becoming poor. Precarity is one of the issues which FEPS, of course, works on.
Absolutely.
This is, I think, so this combination of inequality and a combination of a sense of insecurity, these two are the fuel, the combustion, which creates the extreme reactions against the system. So the anti-systemic mode is there. However, I think that in many ways it is correct that our system has not delivered what we need. So it is true that we do need to really rethink the system we have, the global system we have had over these past years, the Bretton Woods system, which has created basically, I don't call it just globalization, but I would say global capitalism, because it has created wealth in many parts of the world, but it also has created huge inequalities. It has created precarious situations such as the climate change, massive movement of people is very much partly and not only, but very much the question of inequalities, the sense of inequalities. And this is not only a question of inequality, but it's also concentration of wealth. And we see it if you look at the numbers that Oxfam comes out with and others also, the inequality has grown. It has become more massive after the financial crisis. One would have expected that because of the banking system crisis, we would have had a better regulation for making sure that there is a better redistribution of wealth, both within and also globally, and not happened. After the pandemic, we have seen billionaires become even richer, and more than the rest, the 90% or 99%, actually getting poorer globally. But this is not only a wealth issue, it is also a concentration of power.
Yes.
And this concentration of power has undermined our democratic institutions. So when I see the mistrust in democracy, it is actually a mistrust in a democracy that is captured. So I don't see that democracy itself is the problem. The problem is captured institutions. And one could not see it more clearly than in the United States. The power of oligarchs, which Trump had said he would undermine, but has become one with them and is serving them and using them or being used by them, both ways maybe, to further concentrate power, undermine democratic institutions, undermine any kind of checks and balances, and creating scapegoats. And I think this is one of the things we are seeing that the ultra-right is doing. It is looking for a portion of the population. In the past, it could have been the Jews. Now it's the migrants or maybe the Venezuelan crime, you know, criminals or whatever, or those who are students who are protesting or speaking out supposedly about Gaza or whatever. I see that as only a pretext to create a machine of oppression. And luckily, that is what is happening. And we are seeing this in many parts of the world. So I think we need to have a response and say, actually, we need more democracy, not less. We need to liberate our institutions from this capture of these strong oligarchs and so on. And this is one thing we've been talking about in the Council of Europe, starting with an interesting question, which, because, you know, the Council of Europe in many ways is the waiting chamber or the preparatory chamber for membership in the European Union. To some extent. Well, we look at all the human rights issues, the institutional issues, and so on. Not all of the countries of the Council of Europe are going to become members of the European Union. So when Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia were anointed as candidates mm-hmm. for the European Union recently, because of the war, that was the motivation, the trigger, if you like. Prerequisites, one of the new prerequisites for these countries was de-oligarchization.
Mm-hmm.
So the Venice Commission of the Council of Europe prepared a whole paper on discussing with these countries and presented it to us in the Council of Europe about what should be done for de-oligarchization. And there was a big question, is this a systemic problem or is it a question of personalities or persons who just mm-hmm. usurped power? And I think we concluded that this is much more systemic, but it's not only a problem of these countries. It's not mm-hmm. only a problem of former Soviet sphere countries mm-hmm. or whether it's Russia, whether it's Ukraine or others, it's also a problem in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to see that this is a problem. This problem is massive and has really undermined a sense of empowerment of our citizens, also ours, with the control of these oligarchies. Of course, it has also undermined social rights, environmental issues, questions, green transition, and so on.
So when you say West, I suppose you mean both sides of the Atlantic?
Absolutely.
Because it would be very, very easy to say that, okay, the US is a drama, but the European Union is flawless. So I suppose you have a more subtle and critical opinion about the European affairs as well.
Yes, I think that this is true also of Europe. We may not have such blatant oligarchs as in the United States, but there is an increasing sense of inequality, of undermining of social rights and other forms. And this is a global issue. You know, social democracy was built on a social contract, which was, we forget sometimes, but it was a basic agreement between governments, employers and employees. This contract that, yes, we agree that the employer will and the companies will make profits, but that these will be fairly distributed in a way not only for the wage earner but also for public social needs, whether it's education, health, environment, working conditions, and so on. Well, once we globalize capital and it can move wherever it wants, it has no responsibility really to its country. It mm-hmm. has no country. It has no patriotism, if you like. The patriotism is simply amassing wealth. When I was prime minister, one of my basic problems was when people were saying to me, the IMF or even in the European Union, the Commission or the ECB, you must raise taxes to pay mm-hmm. off to cut down the budget deficit, but also pay off the debt. I said, of course, I am ready to do that, and it's going to be painful. But you must then also realize that those who have a lot of money in Greece, the richer ones in Greece, can easily move their money out
mm-hmm.
to tax havens or to some other banks or wherever. So you are asking me to put the burden of the reforms and the transition to a more robust economy, the whole burden on the middle class and on the wage earners.
Mm-hmm.
Very unjust, and I fought to ask for a global tax,
mm-hmm.
to fight for tax havens. The more conservatives in the council always would block it. I had actually the support at some point of Gordon Brown. He then mm-hmm. lost his elections, but he did. We were able to put it into the conclusions of our council. However, in practice, this has not really moved forward. So these are some of the issues that I think Europe has to deal with.
Exactly, because I think a conclusion from what you just explained would be that in the European Union, the fiscal union would be very much a matter of democracy, right? Because a lot of people think about fiscal union as unpredictable burden sharing and transfers, which countries cannot easily control. But the way you put it highlights that there is an element of the democratic deficit, so much connected with the ways and methods of economic governance. And that's also, when it goes wrong, triggers a lot of animosity against the EU itself, not just politicians who might be in office in a certain time.
Yes, I think we need to see that Europe needs a robust economic institutions. People are talking about a minister of finance, but that basically means that there is more of a democratic way of working and institutions to make decisions, where we can be more sovereign in our decisions in dealing with the global economy and the loopholes that the global economy have created, to where money is lost and people then pay for it. If we really want to maintain, which is so important for us, these a social Europe, which is one of the defining, I would say, characteristics of a democratic Europe. Also, these go hand in hand. When you lose the sense of a social Europe, you're undermining your democracy. Also, when you don't have democracy, this will undermine your social Europe or your social contract. Also, so I think these two things go hand in hand, and this is where we need to unify some of our policies. Mm-hmm. We need a more united Europe, and one which is stronger in regulation, the type of regulation at the global level too. Mm-hmm. For example, there were discussions even under Biden about a global tax. Piketty has talked about it. Europe should be a champion of this. Mm-hmm. I know that in Europe some were resisting it. So I think this is where the progressive forces in Europe really need to push. And particularly if we want to really create a more autonomous Europe, mm-hmm. both in defense, but hopefully not just defense, that our defense is also our social system and our democracy.
You think this principle to connect democratic and social integration can also be applied in the context of the EU enlargement? You already touched upon the question of enlargement a little bit, but our listeners should be reminded that you also were foreign minister before becoming prime minister. And at that time, in Thessaloniki, there was a very, very important proclamation, a vision about the future enlargement process. That's over 20 years ago. But I'm approaching this carefully because until recently, most of the discussions on the backsliding focus on the democratic side. But if I translate what you just explained, then we also would need to insist that the enlargement process also has a stronger social dimension. Mm-hmm. How do you see the possibility of that?
I agree with that, and I think that's. I would even say that countries that have been wanting to become members, even the ones that, whether it was Greece in many years ago, actually my father then was prime minister and fought for the so-called, it was then called the Mediterranean programs, but they were basically programs for social cohesion. Mm-hmm. And they were accepted, and then this developed into the cohesion funds and so on. I think that this has to be a main point, a main element of Europe. If Europe is to survive politically, to be cohesive politically, it has to mm-hmm. be cohesive socially. Mm-hmm. It also, I think what we see with the many of the Canada countries, but even some of the new member states, is if you don't have that, you have a huge migration out of these countries, which creates tensions. First of all, I mean, when Greece has lost maybe 400,000 young people, well-educated, they, of course, are thriving maybe in other parts of Europe, and not only Europe. They have
Australia,
even in the Emirates or in the U.S., Canada, and so on, some of them even in Latin America, but basically, of course, in Europe, which, of course, helps Europe generally, but does not help Greece, because Greece, to be able to come out of this or to be able to restructure its economy, it's the younger generation that will do this with mm-hmm. new ideas, with innovation, with their energy, with their knowledge, their skills. And that is also very important even for investment. I mean, if you invest in a country, you're investing in its people. Basically, you're not just buying up land, although we do have that in Greece too. But it's basically investing in people. And if you don't have the right people and you only have people that are basically pensioners, you're not going to have much much investment. And I see this also in countries of Central and Eastern Europe, where a large part of the youth and in the Western Balkans have left, which also means that this has undermined a reform sense, because these people would also want better, more democracy. They would speak about better changes, more changes, and you wouldn't have people in the countryside who feel that there's a sense of, you know, we're dying out. Just, you know, just an older generation that now is sort of insecure and easily then tapped into for extremists, extreme politicians or populists or whatever, authoritarian, who play on the fears of you know, the foreigners are coming in or the, you know, so on and so forth. So I see that if we really want to have these countries cohesive when we and truly part of our democratic tradition, we need to invest in social cohesion and certain types of policies which will allow us to make sure that these countries or that these parts of the world, parts of our regions, are coming together rather than apart.
I think this is very important.
And you, of course, know this well as having been in the commission on this issue.
Yes, of course. But I think also more recently, a lot of people have been blinded by the GDP figures. That, you know, Poland has been developing very well. Romania in the last 10 years have been growing very fast, relatively speaking. And a lot of people just can't imagine what's wrong. And if there are big territorial imbalances within countries,
yes,
or certain parts of these large countries are losing a significant portion of the young population, then the locals might not perceive this as a great success story, despite the GDP figures.
Absolutely. And I think you've written a recent article with Udo Bullmann, I think, on this issue.
This is true.
And the General Secretary of the UN just announced a commission on this issue, basically saying we have to go beyond GDP. We have to look at other metrics. Of a healthy society, basically, I would say. So what is the metric of the Gini coefficient or inequality? Why isn't that part of our, you know, when we fix our budgets, when we do our whatever programs, why isn't this part of it? And or maybe green coefficients too, looking at seeing how the wellness of our citizens. And actually, there's a very good quote of Robert Kennedy many years ago where he says, well, we don't measure the happiness, we don't measure the intelligence, we don't measure how families live, how our relationships with our spouses, with our relation, you know, we don't measure how good, you know, the wellness of our society. We measure the GDP. We measure everything, but we measure the only thing we measure is GDP. So everything that's really essential, we don't measure. So I think he had a point there.
That's the father, Robert Kennedy, and not the...
That's right, yes.
From the 1960s.
That's the brother of John F. Kennedy, who was assassinated, yes.
Indeed.
But to make sure, we need to make that clear.
Yes, and that was also, I would say, a dark chapter of U.S. political history.
Yes.
So many assassinations in the 1960s.
Yes, and still being... still controversial about what was behind these assassinations and still being examined and investigated.
You lived in the U.S. in those times, no? You were a student.
I was in exile, first of all. First of all, I was born in the U.S., but I also grew up both in Minnesota, then in California, Chicago. Then we moved to to Greece. My father decided to come back. He had been in exile also during the Nazi occupation and the Greek dictator then before the Nazis took over Greece. So when we had a dictatorship in the late 60s, my father and my grandfather were jailed. Finally, my father released and he went into exile with us and the family. So we moved around the world, Sweden, Canada, the U.S. I did my studies in the U.S. and Sweden. And this was... So this was a time when I think most of my political interest was because I was exiled and because mm-hmm. we were then in movements fighting for everything from Black is Beautiful to women's rights to gay rights to environmental questions, and of course a fight against the war in Vietnam, the peace movement, which of course politicized me a lot, and with many other fighters from around the world, Latin America, Eastern Europe, and so on. Particularly many in Sweden were from Eastern Europe, exiles fighting for democracy.
Did you already know in the U.S. that you would become a politician, or you only decided when you returned to?
Actually, when I was involved with all these movements, I said I'll never become a politician.
I see.
I think I reached a point in Greece because I did work politically when we were about to become government, and everybody said, "Okay, all hands on deck. Mm-hmm. Let's all make an effort to change Greece." I had been politically active, so I finally got into politics, but a pledge never to become really a professional. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to undermine that word, but or misuse that word. But it's good to be professional. But professional politicians, I don't see it as my career as being. Even though most of my life I've been a politician, but I see it as how can I really serve? How can I bring change? Mm-hmm. How can I, if I'm in an office or if I'm in a position of power, how I can better use it, not for my gain or for my glory, but for how can we serve the people? And I think this is what we need in democratic societies. What I've seen also in this in the Council of Europe, trying to look at our democratic systems, even going back to the ancient Greeks, they didn't have the best of societies, but they were thinking about these issues because they didn't have women, were not elected, not citizens, they had slaves. They actually gave migrants in Athens at some point, at a very progressive time, they gave them citizenship. One of the issues we have been looking at is how do we also innovate in our democratic institutions? So greater participation of citizens, like participatory democracy, deliberative democracy. And I say that because our representative democracy has two sides. One is representing our people.
Yes.
So we have to represent our people. So that is, and that's the main object. The other is getting power. Mm-hmm. We are fighting. It's a competitive fight. Who is going to be in power? Now, in our societies today, with such inequality, so much concentration of power in the wealth, and in the social platforms that are also being controlled, and the debate is basically being controlled by algorithms, not chosen by us, but chosen by these oligarchs. What has dominated more is who is in power, and not how we really represent the people. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one thing that has undermined the trust in democracy. So should we also look at other forms where we can really get people more engaged? That's, of course, a power shift, and there will be resistance to it. So Ireland, for example, took this ancient Greek idea of citizens' assemblies. You randomly choose citizens and you put them to a task for a particular time. They come up with proposals. They deliberate with experts, with other citizens, with groups, and so on. They did that on the very controversial issue, particularly for Ireland, on abortion. Mm-hmm. They came up with a proposal for a change in the constitution and then went to a referendum and it went through. Mm-hmm. So these are new forms. France did it, Macron did it with after the Gilets Jaunes because of the environmental taxes he put on diesel, and which hurt the working class or certain parts of the wage earner class in France. And decided that he would have a citizens' assembly to discuss and decide it. I think these are new forms of bringing in, and there are many other forms too. There are organizations called, for example, Make.org and Mission Publique that do use AI mm-hmm. for democracy. So how do we use our new technologies for people to participate? Let's take an electronic agora, for example, mm-hmm. where you can have every yes. citizen on a website and policies being posted there to be deliberated on. I actually started that when I was prime minister. But now with the with AI, you can actually create certain algorithms that help the debate, but also bring out the areas of consensus and make these transparent algorithms, which basically are the new would be the laws of debate, of which debate. And now, if we look at Facebook, if we look at Twitter, or if we look at others, these companies create an ecosystem of debate, which is, I believe, undermining a real democratic debate.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask, because I think people have probably two convictions on this matter. One is that the AI and digitalization in general bring a lot of opportunities in terms of communication and collecting opinion. On the other hand, it can be very easily abused. So there was the case of the Brexit vote, and there was more lately Romania. It really is, I would even say, a European headache what to do in such a situation, whether the communities become more vulnerable by the use of less transparent channels.
I think it's proven. We don't talk about it maybe as much, and we need to, and I think it has nothing to do with freedom of speech, because this is the thing, let's everything freely. I mean, if you look at what's happening in the U.S., those who are talking about freedom of speech are jailing students because they wrote an article. There was a Turkish woman jailed because she wrote an article around Gaza. So this is a false premise. I think freedom does not exist alone. It exists in a society. It exists if you have rules which you respect the view of the other person. That means we have to have some rules to make sure that freedom does exist. You cannot go in a forest and say I'm just speaking and to the trees and say that's freedom. You speak to another person. So how the debate is conducted is something that either respects freedom or does not respect, or respects democracy or does not. Actually, this goes back to ancient Greece between Socrates and Gorgias, who were talking about. So Gorgias was a great orator, and he would teach rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And he was teaching, and Socrates asked him, well, what do you teach? He says, I teach them to win the argument. And he says, what does that mean? He says, well, they can just win the argument. For what? He says, why to win the argument? For what? Well, for power, for their position, and he says, is that what you really want an argument for? Or do you want to have a real debate to really deepen understanding and understand each other's perspective and maybe come to some consensus or anyway understand the differences? So the idea of what the rules of debate are is very important. And then what we have is we have the rules of debate in these algorithms that either Zuckerberg or Musk or others have created are only profit-seeking. And through that profit-seeking, they have created groups that are fanatic. Why? Because fanaticism keeps you on the issue, keeps you on the iPad or on your phone or on your computer, on the social platform, which then makes more money. So they have purposely created algorithms which do not help debate, but who help cocooning, help fighting each other, debating each other in a way which is not understanding, but by basically hate speech and bullying and so on. So I think we need to have what we might say, and rather than talking about generally the question of freedom and privacy, what if we decided as European Union to have decided if they want to be in Europe, in the European Union, they have to go by our algorithms, not theirs. First of all, they have to reveal what their algorithms are and what they're doing. But secondly, why don't we impose the correct algorithms for real debate and real freedoms and real democratic procedures? So let's create a dome. Allowing them, but have the rules of the game decided by Europe.
Do you think the EU and its leadership have the strength to put forward such a regulation?
That's a good question, and I think, because I was recently in Washington, I think there will be a big fight, and I think that the tariff issue, one of the issues which will be on the table, will be that these platforms will be wanting to be completely free to do what they want without any European regulation. Or they want regulation in favor of their own.
Yes.
Because sometimes we talk about regulation and deregulation. I think that's a bit of a false dilemma. We have regulation whether we want it one way or another. The question is, what does this regulation do? Who does it support? Who does it undermine? What is its purpose? So is regulation helping democratic debate? Is regulation helping our societies learn? Is regulation helping our societies have knowledge, scientific knowledge? Or is this regulation allowing for, you know, bots, millions of bots to support a candidate in Romania and create a sense that there's a huge wave of support which, you know, has nothing to do with reality, but does in fact shape reality in the end?
Well, we have been discussing democracy, which of course is a Greek word, and you mentioned the agora and many other elements of your great tradition. I mean, do you think the Greek environment helps people to kind of more deeply think about questions of the contemporary democracy and its future?
I definitely think there's the opportunity. We don't always do that, and I've been Minister of Education also in Greece, and one thing that I saw is we were pushing much more to learn the ancient Greek language, but we didn't really want to learn too much about the ancient Greek philosophers and the debates they had. And I think that comes back from a somewhat of an authoritarian tradition. We had went through dictatorships, we went through civil war, and our school curriculum who developed the school curriculum weren't too happy to have thinking citizens. They wanted citizens much more passive, and I think this, of course, is something which our education systems, not only in Greece, have a problem, because we are focused so much on the professional training, which is important. But we don't even know if these professions will exist in 5 or 10 years or 15 years. But we don't educate for citizenship. And I think this is another area which is very important. And our schools really need to become the crucible, the center of democratic education, of really building up the possibility to understand the issues, to understand the problems, to deal with the big questions, and help empower our youth to deal with these issues. But if we want, yes, you just have to walk around the Agora, walk around the Pnyx, look how they use. I mean, I, for example, I was inspired in when I was prime minister. We had to fight corruption. One of the reasons why Greece had a fiscal problem or a financial problem, it was not simply we overspent. It was also, and I have to be open about this, government corruption. You know, money spent to friends, to clientelistic politics, to procurement, to people who shouldn't have got it, and so on. Things we've seen also in other parts of the world too. So what did the ancient Athenians do? They had on these marble plaques every single financial transaction of the government, the local, the city, had to be posted on these marble plaques. And every citizen had the right to then take it to court if he thought, it was a he, not a she, but let's say any citizen could have taken it to court if they thought that this was not a correct investment, or there was some corruption behind it, and so on. So what I did is I created a wall too, but it was not a marble wall, it was the internet, a platform, and I created a law, a very simple one, saying that no financial transaction, local, central government, anywhere, is legal unless it is posted on the web. So today, every citizen of Greece, and not only, outside Greece too, can just go in and see where their money goes. And that, of course, was just one measure to fight corruption. But I'm just saying that it is going back to the experience. They were experimenters. And I think that democracy is still in work under construction. It's progress, and if things change, we have to rethink it. But some of the basic principles need to be maintained. And one of the basic principles is we do believe in the rule of our citizens. We do believe, we do trust our citizens. We do want democratic debate is also peaceful debate. So it came out of many generations of Greeks reading the Odyssey and the Iliad, where particularly the Iliad was an anti-war text. So they said, okay, why should we be fighting and killing each other? Let's find other ways to deal with our issues, which was through debate. And of course, the concentration and abuse of power was another very big, deeper issue that has to be there. We have huge concentration of power. The ancient Greeks would say, this is not a democracy. You can't have, this is an oligarchy.
Is it true that in the ancient Athenians could vote to expel somebody from the community?
Yes.
What was the name of this? I'm sure there was a...
Alcibiades, yes. He was considered one of the most honorable citizens, but they thought that maybe this was, it had gone too much to his head. Mm-hmm. So the sense of arrogance or sense of hubris, supposedly to be condemned by the gods, but in the end, condemned by the citizens. They were not flawless. They had their problems. But this is one way to make sure that, you don't get an authoritarian figure usurping power and abusing power. So they had this power to exile even leaders, even some of the best.
Mm. Well, I think this is a very, very fascinating warning, because in Europe, but also elsewhere, there is indeed concentration of power. And I'm grateful for you to highlighting, let's say, the importance of citizens learning about all this, because there are so many technicalities, like the digital tools or the trade, all the news about trade. People just believe export and import, and you explain very well that it's also about the values.
Absolutely.
How people live, how people interact, how societies develop.
Absolutely. And you know, I've talked to Joe Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner. He's now also on this commission that Antonio Guterres has created in the UN. When he talks about trade, he says, it wasn't really that free trade in this globalization. If you look at the trade deals of the US multinationals, the trade deals were specifically having clauses which would be preferential to these corporations vis-a-vis the workers inside, let's say, a Latin American country. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if there would be a strike and there would be losses of the corporation, the American corporation, according to the trade deal, the country would be liable for these losses and not the corporation. So these are types of... So that's why I say regulation, we need regulation, but we need to see what that regulation really does. Does it help our citizens? Is it for our citizens? Is it for growth? And I think one thing you've been also talking about, and now it's become quite a new word in the United States, this idea of abundance, you know, that we need to move from scarcity to abundance. Investing in social Europe, or in our society and our citizens, for better education, better health, allows our society to thrive and allows for economic development. It's not the undermining of economic development. So try to look at it as a balance. If we invest too much in social welfare, too much in education, this will undermine our budgets, and therefore we will have problems in our economy and our competitiveness. No, this is where we should be competitive, and where will make us, truly thrive in this new global world.
Mm-hmm. So that's about taking care of our future.
It is about taking care of our future, and I think also, now we should. Obviously, that Europe now has this major challenge of becoming more autonomous, not only in defense. We need to see that defense has. The investment is certainly dual use, so it can help our society in innovation. Some countries have done this, the U.S. certainly, but it also should not undermine our social welfare. Mm. And we should also see how we open up to the so-called global South. It's a very fuzzy term, but certainly even with China in some areas, the issue of climate change. Environmental issues, but I would even say Africa. Why are we trying to compete with the Chinese in Africa, not sit down with them and say, actually, we do want development in Africa. Maybe we can put some rules of how we invest and how we make sure that these investments are good, first of all, for the Africans themselves, but then useful for us, because we have the fastest growing population in the world is in Africa, and we will be dealing with this sooner or later if we don't help. And it would be in our interest too if we have a growing Africa economically.
Well, that's another avenue of the present and the future, which I think we cannot fully discuss today. But I'm really grateful for your time and explaining your activities and concerns in the Council of Europe, how to deal with democracy and also the connection between the democratic and the social development, and especially for proving that, you know, recalling ideas and conversations from the distant past actually can help better understanding of our present, but also the challenges of the future.
Absolutely. Thank you, Laszlo, for this conversation.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Goodbye.